From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now, and it's a new year, so welcome to 2021. In Washington, Congress is still trying to wrap up the work of 2020. The Senate will meet and is expected to override President Trump's veto of a defense policy bill. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders tried and failed to force a vote on those $2,000 coronavirus relief checks that President Trump called for. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calls it socialism for rich people. Joining us now with the latest is Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Happy New Year and welcome back, Rick.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, so we saw a last gasp effort today from Senator Sanders on those $2,000 coronavirus relief checks. What has the fight over these checks revealed really about our politics? Some people really need this money.
Yeah, people need the money. People are desperate out there. But there are objections that are coming from different corners of the Republican Party. President Trump endorsed these larger checks in his pseudo threat to veto the government funding bill and the COVID relief bill. He ended up signing the bill, but the push for that additional money goes on. And he has found some unlikely allies in Democrats, including Bernie Sanders, who've long said that there needs to be more direct relief to the American people. Standing in their way, though, are Senate Republicans. Mitch McConnell, not a fan of those additional payments. Several of his colleagues talking about the impact on the national debt and the deficit, and also concerned that a lot of the money would be going to people who really don't need it. And that's what leaves us in this legislative deadlock with this current session of Congress about to expire. There is no realistic process for those bigger checks to go out. The smaller checks of $600 per individual are on their way out the door, but the larger checks, that does not seem likely to happen.
Okay, I want to ask you more about this argument about the checks to people with higher incomes. This week, the nonpartisan think tank, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, reviewed whether $2,000 stimulus checks would go to households earning six figures under this plan that the House approved. And it rated it as largely true, but it also found that checks to really high income families would be rare. So do you think that this House bill is going to color the debate over passing more aid next year? Or really this year?
I think it's going to be a different dynamic.
I'm already doing this thing where I'm saying next year, this year. Yeah, this year.
Right. Happy 2021. This year is going to have different dynamics, starting really in 3 weeks when President-elect Biden becomes president. The Democrats are going to have a slightly smaller majority in the House, but they still have the prospects, depending on the Georgia runoff elections next week, of taking the Senate majority. So I think that the politics are going to be different. But I think the concern now that's being raised about those larger checks is that there's no testing as to whether a household actually needs the money. There are some middle income, say, low six-figure households that would get it that are perfectly fine, that are fully employed. There are other households that don't have any sources of income right now after previously making decent incomes in the past, and this is a real lifeline for them. And I think you're going to see a change also that there's a number of Democrats that want to see this aid go directly to states and municipalities that have huge holes in their budgets, that may be a better way to target relief. That's been a non-starter under President Trump and under Republican control of the Senate. Whether the dynamics are different if the Democrats control the Senate and when Biden is president is going to be a question for a few weeks from now.
Yeah, let's talk about Georgia now. So stopping socialism has been the rallying cry for the two Senate Republicans running for re-election in runoff races this week. Now one of them, David Perdue, has to quarantine because he says he was exposed to the coronavirus. Have the Democratic candidates been able to really cut through the noise and get out the vote? What has this runoff become a test of?
Well, early voting does seem to favor Democrats, but it always favors Democrats. And I think their concern is, can you build up enough of a lead to overcome the Republican turnout effort on Election Day itself? We have Senator Harris coming to the state on Sunday, and then President-elect Biden and President Trump will both be in Georgia on Monday, showcasing how important this race is. It's unprecedented to have this double barrel runoff situation that is literally going to determine control of the Senate and maybe the course of the Biden agenda, his ability to get nominees confirmed, the ability to control the Senate floor when it comes to legislation, all of that very much on the line for the first 2 years of the Biden presidency with what happens next week. And it becomes a test of loyalty to Trump, because both of the Republican candidates there are very much pro-Trump and have established themselves as as kind of bulwarks against what they say is a creeping socialism. And I think a test for Democrats as to whether they can keep some momentum going after the Biden wins in Georgia and a few other red states and begin to remake the electoral map. Realistically, Republicans were long thought to have the advantage in these Senate races as the incumbents, and particularly in runoffs. But I think the conventional wisdom has shifted a bit.
So much to talk about and watch out for next week. We'll also have the certifying of the Electoral College tally. Thank you so much for all of your work with us this year. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we talked a lot of politics on social media in 2020, and to break down some of the conversations of the year online, we have with us Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Happy New Year, Femi.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Yes, so let's start with the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer. They popped up in thousands of places around the world after George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis back in May. And social was a significant part of this movement, wasn't it?
Tony, I'm going to say that social was a critical part of this movement. I'm going to tell you about a youngster called Dinella Frazier. She was 17 in mid-May, and she was heading to a grocery store with her little cousin. She stopped when she saw the police surround a black man who was being pinned to the ground. That man was George Floyd. She took out her phone and she started to film. When she got home, she posted that video on Facebook, and she posted, "They killed him right in front of Cup Foods over south on 38th and Chicago. No type of sympathy. Two broken hearts emoji. Hashtag police brutality." And of course, we all know that video was shared so many times that we now know George Floyd's name, how he was treated by police. But videos like this, they create huge, big ethical conversations. Should you film people being hurt, in danger or in distress? Should you document their distress, or should you put your phone down and step in to help them? So on Darnella's Facebook page, there are lots of criticisms about what she did. Marius Jean, for instance, says, "Couldn't you try to help him instead of obscenely filming his last living moments with your smartphone? Was that just social networking more important to you than the man's life?" But there were lots of people who were supporting her, saying thank you very much. Even to this day, you can still see that post on her Facebook page. And I contend that if we didn't see this video, if we didn't see Dinella Frazier's video, would the Black Lives Matter movement have reached so many more people in the US and beyond this year? Would we still be talking about George Floyd, which I'm convinced we will be, not just in 2021, but in many years to come, without Dinella Frazier, a teenager, picking up her phone and filming what happened to George Floyd? That is my takeaway from that whole terrible incident that happened back in May.
Mm-hmm. And that mechanism of these social media platforms, as you said, just let that go viral. It went viral because of that. Of course, the pandemic was also a trending topic in 2020. A lot of us got the latest info from Twitter and Facebook, but the pandemic also highlighted the dark parts of the medium, the spread of lies and false information. This was the year some social media companies finally took some real steps to stop misinformation.
It was amazing, Tonya. These social media companies, we're too big, we've got too many followers, we can't do this, we can't monitor what everybody has to say. And the fact was that we had not just a pandemic, but an infodemic, as the World Health Organization called it. This was the first pandemic where we had technology and social media to help us, but also to hurt us. So the World Health Organization called the infodemic an overabundance of information, both online and offline, that is potentially dangerous. So as early as February of this year, that was before any of the US lockdowns had happened, they had a meeting, the World Health Organization had a meeting with Google to talk about their search algorithms. And what they wanted to do was, when you search coronavirus, when you search COVID, what pops up first? The World Health Organization or your health organization, the health authorities in your country? They managed to do that. And Tonya, I tried this out just before we came on air. I typed into Twitter COVID. I got COVID-19 updates for the US, all reliable sources. I typed into YouTube COVID. I was sent straight to the CDC. on Instagram, I'm sent to the WHO, and my posts, if I mention COVID, are tagged with the WHO. TikTok, all of these big social media companies are now able to tell you where there is good information, so you don't have to follow either the misinformation about COVID and vaccines, which is probably our big concern going into 2021. Yeah. So you've got that accurate information. It doesn't mean we're going to read it, but it's definitely there for us.
Yes. You know, a ritual so many of us love is watching the New Year celebrations on TV, including the Times Square broadcast. It still happened this year, but without the crowds. What are you seeing in terms of reactions on social? What are people saying with the short amount of time I have with you?
Well, Times Square called this a virtual ball drop, and the official name for the countdown was a 60-second Kia countdown to midnight. People were horrified that they were seeing more of a Kia car than they were of the ball drop or the countdown. Gupta Musings, for instance, says the countdown to the ball drop in NYC felt more like a countdown to the world ending, sponsored by Kia.
And we're hearing it right there, the Times Square broadcast, which is a familiar sound. Femi Yoke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, as always, thank you and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Take care, everybody. Have a good one.
Here's a startling fact. Concession stand workers can often make more than NFL cheerleaders. That's the subject of a new PBS Independent Lens documentary called A Woman's Work, the NFL's Cheerleader Problem. This pay disparity came to light back in 2014 after a series of lawsuits raised by cheerleaders who say they were underpaid and sexually harassed. Joining us now is the filmmaker behind A Woman's Work. We welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Your documentary tells the story of the pay issue through the experiences of two former cheerleaders, Lacey, who's a former Raiders cheerleader, and Maria, a former Buffalo Bill Jill. What drew you to tell these stories?
It's interesting because I really didn't know much about football or cheerleading until I came to Los Angeles to USC. I realized how insanely popular football is here in this country, and that really it is America's favorite pastime. And so when I heard about Lacey's lawsuit, which happened a week before the Super Bowl in 2014, I heard that she was paid less than minimum wage, less than $5 an hour for being such a prominent figure in the entertainment, in the culture of the game in the NFL. That was just mind-blowing to me. And I think it really struck a chord because, you know, as someone who is, as a woman who's born as only child in China, I've grown up with this understanding that misogyny is a thing. And coming here as an immigrant to a democracy, you have expectations of equality, for example. And so just seeing this sort of extreme inequality was something that really piqued my interest, and I wanted to dig deeper. I wanted to find out more about Lacey, you know, what brought her to speak out and what her fight was going to look like, really, as she took on this legal battle.
There is a distinction that the NFL has made about this, and that's that the teams are responsible for paying the cheerleaders, not the NFL. Why is this distinction important?
Well, I think that distinction is important for the NFL because it helps them sort of push away the responsibility. Unfortunately, in the case of the Buffalo Jills, they actually filed for a motion to be dismissed from the case as a defendant, but the judge refused them. So right now they are a defendant in that case, which makes them legally responsible.
To bring home the disparity in pay, your documentary lays out the average salary in 2014 of an NFL player, which is about $420,000 a year. A mascot up to $65,000 a year, and then a Raiderette cheerleader, just $1,250 a year. What are the reasons the teams give for why cheerleaders who spend upwards of 60 to 70 hours working on behalf of a team are paid so low?
The team's attitude is that the women should feel lucky to have this opportunity to cheer, to be part of this organization that is so meaningful, that, you know, they should feel grateful that they're considered to be sort of the best of the best and sort of the most beautiful and attractive women around, that this role is beneficial to them and it's sort of this invaluable benefit to them, and therefore they do not need to be paid legally. And I guess they, in a way, they kind of spin it as this is not really a job, and it's almost like charity, or like giving back to your team, giving back to your community.
This is also the sentiment of many fans, which you illustrate really well in this documentary. I mean, people arguing exactly what you said. Hey, these cheerleaders signed these contracts. They knew what they were getting into. There's also former cheerleaders who felt like they were betrayed by the women who filed these lawsuits. But ultimately, what this battle over pay has shed light on is this perception of what cheerleaders represent. Let's listen to some of this from your documentary.
No, nobody cares about the Joes. No, honestly, yeah. No, I'm not. Like, all they do is, like, tramp themselves out for guys, drunk guys. No,
which is you every time you go to a Bills game.
No, it's not, dude.
They make $10 an hour for you to shovel out the stadium.
Yeah.
They could at least get that.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, younger girls are growing up trying to accept themselves for who they are, and they can't because they see all these women that are tiny little stick figures. And I don't agree with the image that a lot of these NFL cheerleaders are portraying.
Wee, you've laid out really well in this documentary how low pay signifies how society views cheerleaders. But maybe a bigger question for you is whether cheerleaders still hold an important role in society and sports. Are they still relevant? That's something that many viewers may come away with after watching your documentary.
Yeah, I think that is a great question. And I think all throughout this, the process of these lawsuits that came out in 2014 and then later on in 2018, a lot of the reactions of the general public is, you know, why don't we just get rid of cheerleaders? And I can understand that sentiment for sure. But the reality is, cheerleaders are still a part of these sports teams. They're still a huge part of the game day entertainment that, you know, happens. And even in this season of the pandemic, you see on Thanksgiving, the Dallas Cowboys game, that there was a huge halftime show featuring the Cowboys cheerleaders. I think part of it is, if these teams are going to employ women, employ these cheerleaders, they need to be treated fairly. And also, I think the women themselves need to be given, they need to be empowered to really evolve their roles, to evolve their industry and sort of even the creative aspect of who they are and how they're marketed. Because I think in the clip you heard, you know, the woman saying, you know, they're just, I don't agree with sort of the very skinny sort of physical body type mm-hmm. that these cheerleaders embody. Well, you know, that's not necessarily what they chose. I think it goes back to how our society views female sexuality, views women's bodies. And I think right now, in terms of rape culture, toxic masculinity, I think there's the idea that men are just entitled to women's bodies and their affection and their beauty. It should be a given. It should be free. So, you know, if these women are asking to be paid, then somehow it goes, you know, into the arena of prostitution. And I think that view really needs to change.
What's been the response to the film from professional cheerleaders?
Definitely, there's been women who have seen the film who really feel like it's a great reflection of their experience as professional cheerleaders. And they do feel emboldened and empowered to sort of flip the narrative on who they are. You know, they're not just there to be seen and not heard. They have a voice. They have opinions. And there's definitely been some feedback from former cheerleaders that still follow the same kind of the same script as when the lawsuits first came out, saying, well, you know, if they really didn't like the job, why don't they just get another job? And I really hope that after watching the film, they do have time to sort of sit with it and think that over a little bit, because it's not impossible to both love your experience as a cheerleader and also be treated fairly, be paid fairly, and to have a safer workplace.
As the documentary progresses, it becomes clear that this movie is also about gender roles. You kind of touched on this just a few moments ago, but that it's sometimes really hard, especially in certain professions, to be both ambitious and a mother. Was that a revelation to you?
It was fascinating as we were, you know, making this documentary. It really took, you know, 4 or 5 years to finish filming and edit the film. And we, in that time, we did a lot of research and we found a lot of amazing archival footage around the themes of, you know, what you're talking about, which is gender roles, the gendered nature of work and labor and what that really means to American mythology, you know, the foundations of American society, this kind of mythology that is ingrained in all of us, whether we're born here or if we come here as immigrants. Mm. And when you peel that back and when you look at it, you know, a lot of it tells you that women's work, women, you know, who work in the home is not, it's not valuable. You don't get money for that. It's something that is just natural, is just a given. And then following, you know, Lacey and Maria's personal lives as well, during this process, you see, you know, Lacey has 2 more children, and she has, you know, 3 children by the end of the film. And she's the one who's doing most of the childcare. She's doing, and as well as trying to work outside of the home and teach dance. And Maria, she's really the one who's doing all of the sort of caregiving work when it comes to her mom, who becomes sick with breast cancer. And similarly, she also takes care of her father. So all of these forms of labor in women's lives, you know, it takes up all of our lives, and yet they're unacknowledged and people don't view it as valuable in the sense of giving any kind of monetary value or even respect sometimes. So I think that's definitely something that came out in this process. And in many ways, a woman's work, this film is about sort of looking at all those different types of emotional labor, invisible labor that women have to take on. And, you know, while that's not necessarily going to go away anytime soon, I think that at the same time, we can be proud and we can redefine, reinvigorate the term a woman's work with this kind of dignity and respect that we are doing all of these types of labor that really make the world go round. And we should have respect for that.
That's filmmaker, director, and producer of A Woman's Work, The NFL's Cheerleader Problem, which airs next week on January 4th on PBS's Independent Lens. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Many low-wage workers across the country are getting a raise today. 20 states and 32 cities and counties are raising the minimum wage. The increase ranges from a few cents an hour to a dollar or more, and the changes are part of a larger move towards a $15 an hour minimum wage. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, for more. Happy New Year, Mike.
A happy New Year to you, Tanya. Thank you.
Yes. So where are the biggest increases happening today, and what's the bigger picture nationally on where minimum wage stands?
Yeah, so as you pointed out in the introduction, some states actually are raising the minimum wage by a dollar or more, including California, Illinois, New Jersey for most types of jobs. New Mexico is actually moving it up by $1.50 to $10.50 an hour. But what's important, and as you say, what's the sort of full scope of this? There's more coming later in the year. A total of 74 places will raise their minimum wages by the end of the year. That's according to an analysis by the National Employment Law Project. So very much across the board, across the U.S., there are minimum wage workers who will see raises this year.
Yeah, many business owners, though, are pleading with officials to reconsider because they say minimum wage hikes will force them to lay off even more workers when they're already struggling to stay open, especially right now. How much evidence is there that raising minimum wage hurts businesses?
So the consensus does seem to be that there could be sort of a net loss of jobs if the minimum wage is raised nationally. The Congressional Budget Office analyzed what would happen if the minimum wage was put up to $15 an hour by 2026. That's what was called for in the Raise the Wages Act that actually was passed in the House but died in the Senate in 2019. So they estimate about 1.3 million jobs would be lost. I will say, though, that there is a lot of uncertainty around how that would actually play out. There are so many other sort of variables in the economy that could influence that figure that there's not a ton of confidence in what the exact net result would be.
I'm really curious. The federal minimum wage has stayed at $7.25 an hour since 2009. What do economists say about the impact of minimum wage hikes on the economy's long-term recovery?
They do seem to agree that raising the minimum wage is a net benefit to the economy, especially when it's sort of broad-based like this. There is a lot of debate and argument about whether the timing right now, as we're emerging from the pandemic and hopefully in this year put it behind us, that businesses that were already struggling because of the lockdowns and everything else will have a hard time raising the wage. But, isolated, the idea of a higher minimum wage, I think most economists do agree is a net benefit to the economy.
Yeah, very quickly, less than 30 seconds. Black and Latino people make up a large share of hourly workers. So how much of an impact will raising a minimum wage, you think, have on closing the racial wealth gap in this country?
Well, it depends how you look at it. That same CBO report estimated more than 1 million people would be pulled out of poverty. But at the same time, the rich certainly are getting much richer this year because of the stock market. So that gap's not likely to close too dramatically anytime soon.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya. Happy New Year.
Every year, there's lots of buzz around these lists of dynamic people shaping our world. There's 20 under 20, 40 under 40, and Slate magazine recently revived its 80 over 80 list, 80 of the most influential Americans who are 80 years old and older. We'll link to the full list at hereandnow.org. Slate reporter Molly Almstead says this decade-old project is, in a way, meant to poke fun at society's obsession with youthful exceptionalism.
Shortly before we published it, there was the Forbes 30 Under 30, and a lot of people feeling, I don't want to say depressed, but there is just like a little bit of a bummer to some degree, because it is such an absurd thing to highlight or just put on a pedestal all this achievement at such a young age, when if you look at the reality, so much of the power in America is actually people who are quite old.
Making the list is former CBS News anchor Dan Rather, who Slate describes as a, quote, archetype of the sober, authoritative, old school American newsman. Some of that actually shines through in his latest book, What Unites Us, U.S. Reflections on Patriotism, touching on themes of resilience and hope. And he's right on the news through his Facebook and Twitter feed, which is full of sharp political analysis and blunt explanations of current events. Dan Rather, Happy New Year, and welcome to Here and Now.
Well, a Happy New Year to you and to everybody listening. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, so you've been on quite a few lists in your lifetime. You're one of the most influential and powerful journalists in the country. What's your reaction to being included on this list, and maybe how we value in our society older people?
Well, first of all, I'm very appreciative of the honor, and I do consider it to be an honor. I say that with a great smile, because the longer I go, the more I know how important it is not to take yourself too seriously. So, you know, frankly, I'm 89 years old, but I'm still trying to get used to the fact that I'm over 80. to be included in a list of, 80 over 80, it still takes a little getting used to me, but I only have a year to get used to it before I move into my 90s, Lord willing. But I do go into every day, and I was thinking today that I'm just so grateful to have been able to live this long and generally speaking, have my health, that I shouldn't be complaining about anything.
I know all of us need to take that lesson. And who knows, there'll be a 90 over 90 list, hopefully sometime soon, that you might be on. You're also Twitter famous, Dan. You've been tweeting scathing rebukes of President Trump and have spoken pretty bluntly about the need for economic relief. How liberating is it for you to talk freely while also being a part of the discourse?
Well, Twitter has been a pleasant surprise to me, which at least a borderline shock, that I was slow to come into Twitter. I was not eager to do it. I thought, it's too short a form for me. But I work, my company is called News and Guts, and I have a lot of young people on staff anyway. Some time ago, they encouraged me, almost demanded that I try Twitter. And as I say, it's been a very pleasant surprise. For one thing, on Twitter, you can use humor a lot more than what I would call, regular news platforms. At any rate, I have enjoyed it a great deal. And, we'll see going into 2021 whether as many people pay attention to Twitter as they have in over the last 4 years, but that's yet to be determined.
Yeah. How would you describe the connection you feel with Americans on social media? I mean, you spent 24 years talking directly to us every night as the anchor for CBS News. That's a deep connection, but it's also different because you weren't having conversations with us the way you do on social media.
Well, exactly. The social media in many ways is much more satisfying because it is a conversation. Whereas when you do a standard newscast over traditional television, it's a one-way conversation by and large. People can write you letters and that sort of thing. But social media has its downside, its dark side, as you and I both know, and it's some negative things about it. But for one who, a practitioner, if you will, in it, the biggest thing about it is you build a community and you have a conversation with the community, you get feedback. And frankly, I learn a great deal. And I can't read every comment that comes through, but I do read, you know, regularly in the comments. And I learn a lot. And frequently what I learn is that I've been wrong about something. It's great to have the two-way conversation with people.
And in thinking about learning from mistakes, your retirement from CBS News in the mid-2000s followed this debacle involving a piece that ran on 60 Minutes about President Bush's National Guard service, which was later discovered to be erroneous due to some unauthenticated documents. What lessons did you learn from that?
Well, I learned a lot of humility from it without going into the details and getting into any argument about what was true and what wasn't true. I learned humility, which is not a word generally associated with past or present television anchor people. I learned who my real friends were, and you know, many people that I thought were friends turned out not to be. But I also learned that when you get knocked down, you have to get up. It's not healthy for your career. It's not healthy for you to stay down. And it was a hard knockdown, and it was not easy to take. But what I tried to do was take a deep breath, suck it up, and get up and say, well, all right, a lot has gone right in my career, to say the least. And it's not nearly over. I still have my health. I still want to work. And so I went right back to work trying to rebuild what was left of my career.
Do you worry that the errors we make as journalists erode public trust in journalism? I mean, I'm thinking about the situation we're in today where many people don't trust us. They get their information from social media, or they believe in conspiracy theories. Do you take or feel any responsibility in that way?
Well, I do, and I certainly do worry about that. And the answer to what we can do about it is, the first thing is do our jobs as well as we can do them, and keep in mind that anytime we make a mistake, we need to own up to the mistake and explain what happened, be very transparent. But I do worry about it going forward, when people ask themselves, well, where can I get news that I depend on? And I think an important part of going forward will be to educate the upcoming generations, say, to be more knowledgeable and discerning consumers of news, is going to be a very important part of it, because this business of public distrust of the media and various leaders, including political leaders, trying to diminish our trust is not going to go away. It's going to be with us going forward.
Mm-hmm. I love this tweet that you tweeted recently. I met a lot of you here in 2020. That was nice. The rest of the year was pretty much a dumpster fire, igniting a nuclear meltdown. I mean, we all hope 2021 is better. What are you hopeful for in this new year?
Well, I'm really hopeful for that the country will get an important new start. This is by no means assured, because some of our problems of 2020 are destined to overlap into 2021, first and foremost, the pandemic. And as we're already seeing with the lack of coordination of getting the vaccines out, this is very discouraging as we begin to start 2021. So we have to keep in mind that some of the problems are going to overlap. But the thing I'm really looking forward to, that the new year gives us, and a new administration gives us a chance to sort of get a new start, a restart, if you will. I do think that if if we can get the pandemic under control in some reasonable amount of time, which we, by the way, as you and I speak, we've not demonstrated we can do that. But if we can do that, then I think 2021 could turn out to be a pretty good year. There certainly will be economic difficulties still flowing in the wake of the pandemic. But, you know, it's part of turning the new calendar is having new hope. And my hopes are high. I think they're not unrealistic, but my hopes are high that we as a country, as a people, as a society can get a fresh new start. And that new start will be a whole lot better than what we experienced in the year just past.
So looking forward to that new fresh start. And you just made it on this 80 for 80 list at 89 years old. So happy early birthday, Dan Rather, and happy new year.
Well, happy new year to you. And thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today. Hope you have a great new year.
That's legendary journalist Dan Rather, one of the most influential Americans honored in Slate's 80 over 80 list. 2020 may be over, but the changes it brought are not. Just look at the TV industry. The pandemic halted production for much of the year. A civil rights reckoning upended longstanding shows. And now blockbuster movies are coming to streaming services on the same day they hit movie theaters. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to discuss a revolutionary year. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with two year-end recommendations. You're a fan of The Mandalorian on Disney+. The Star Wars show just wrapped up its second season. What made it special?
Well, they resurrected, for me, the Star Wars franchise. They found fresh ideas in these characters that had kind of been kind of overlooked by the big movies. Chief among those characters is this character, the Mandalorian, a really amazing fighter who takes it upon himself to take this creature that seems to be from the same race as Yoda, the Jedi Master, and try to take this creature to another Jedi Knight who might be able to teach him how to use his powers. So the Mandalorian demonstrates to this Jedi that he actually has powers, and we have a clip. Let's listen to it.
Do you want this? That's right, take it. Come on. You can have it. Come on. Good job. Good job, kid. You see that? That's right. I knew you could do it. Very good.
He's formed a strong attachment to you. I cannot train him.
What?
So that's Rosario Dawson playing Ahsoka, a Jedi Knight. And they figured out another way to tell Star Wars stories that is really exciting. And so it's no wonder that Disney has announced about 10 new Star Wars shows for the Disney Plus streaming service, just continuing the work that they've done on The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm. You also liked HBO's I May Destroy You. What struck you about this show?
Well, the thing about this is a very different series. It's a drama, and it stars Michaela Cole as this woman who has a night out, and then she starts to have these flashbacks, and she begins to piece together the notion that her drink might have been spiked and she might have been sexually assaulted. She's not sure about it. And so we have a clip where she goes to the police and they have a bit of a conversation. Here it is.
Do you have any reason to believe that this friend of yours, Simon or DeRay, would spike your drinks or want to hurt you in any way?
No. There were another two. We didn't know them, so I don't know. It wouldn't have been Simon. He's my friend. He's one of my best friends. He really is. He wasn't even in Camden, I guess. He just left me somewhere, which is quite weird.
There's a sort of denial there, and of course the police have a sense that something's happening, so they're trying to draw it out of her. But, you know, this is just one part of a larger story that the series tells, where it really takes a look at the legacy of this kind of sexual trauma through generations. It talks about how people who are abusers can have their own history of abuse. There's messaging and storytelling about differences in race and class. It's on a lot of critics' best of lists, and people didn't get a chance to see it when it debuted, you know, earlier this year. They really should check it out.
Good recommendations. Let's discuss some of the broader trends in television. Social justice protests over the summer prompted the Paramount Network to cancel the show Cops, which has been on the air for over 3 decades. You and I have talked extensively about this.
Yep.
Another reality show following police officers, Live PD, also got canned. How significant is this? Is the industry really making moves to address racism?
Well, I think ultimately the answer to that question kind of remains to be seen. The reckoning over civil rights led a lot of people to look at TV shows that maybe they hadn't paid a lot of attention to before and sort of ask themselves, you know, what is this show really doing? Is it unfairly propping up police officers and making them look like they're always right in the field? Is it unfairly demonizing the poor and people of color, who are the people who are normally featured as suspects? So there was a lot of good reasons to have both of these shows get canceled. We just have to see what happens in the long run.
Before I let you go, streaming services, like, we're all into them right now. Big movies have debuted on them alongside movie theaters. Last weekend was Wonder Woman 1984. Have the lines between film and TV been totally erased by this pandemic?
I don't think they have, but I do think those boundaries have gotten murkier, right? I think people do still want to have a communal viewing experience. And once we get the pandemic under control, people will be eager to gather together again. But while that's not happening, people will get used to watching big budget movies in their home on the day that they're released. And I don't think there's any way to put that genie back in the bottle. So movie theaters will be diminished, but I think people still want that experience. So I think they'll still hang around.
I always enjoy our conversations, Eric. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year. May 2021 be so much better than what we had to endure in 2020.
Absolutely. That's NPR's TV critic, Eric Deggans. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley. Happy New Year. It's Here and Now.